Well, I think all sensible people have the British Constitution as one of their hobbies. It is the most interesting matter to discuss and be informed about. As Dicey said, Dicey argued, it is Parliament that is the defender of the liberties of the people, of our ancient constitution and of our freedoms. I give way.
Hello, this is Jacob Rees-Mogg. I'm sure you will agree there can be no finer pastime than learning about the United Kingdom's constitution and our Parliament's place within it. So I have been delighted to speak to some of the people most able to shed light on how our system of parliamentary democracy really operates and explain why Parliament works. People like Natasha Engel, the former Deputy Speaker.
Had it not been for the doorkeepers, I don't know what I would have done. They taught me everything I knew and I was extremely grateful. So that would be my one big piece of advice to new members is get to know the doorkeepers.
Lord Norton, the noted constitutionalist.
The focus tends to be on the formal stages because they're visible and from point of view of political science, they're measurable. But what it misses out is the use of what I tend to refer to as informal space within Parliament.
And Chloe Smith, the Minister for the Constitution.
What I always think is you know, the critical function of the Constitution actually is to enable people to be able to get on with their everyday lives without interference and with protection from interference.
Throughout these conversations, exploring why Parliament works has meant two things. First, explaining why our parliamentarians do all they do to help deliver for our democracy by passing legislation which helps the government achieve its priorities for the people. And secondly, exploring a little more about some of the unseen and perhaps underappreciated parts of our lawmaking process, which make our apparently chaotic system so effective in delivering for voters. In this opening episode, I wanted to begin by assessing the role of Parliament in our Constitution, and was able to do just that in conversation with one of this country's most respected and esteemed professors.
The great thing about our Constitution is there is always something more to learn about it, and in particular about the role played by Parliament within it. I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Vernon Bogdaner, unquestionably one of the most distinguished constitutionalists in the country. Vernon, I think the question to start with is, in a crisis, why does Parliament matter? Why can't we just leave it to the executive to get on with things?
Well, Jacob, thank you for that very generous introduction. Perhaps it's not too difficult to be a constitutionalist in a country which doesn't have a constitution. But really, Parliament is our constitution. And, of course, a lot of the argument about Brexit was returning us to the sovereignty of Parliament, which we had before we joined the European Community, as the European Union then was in 1973. And Parliament is, of course, at the centre of our constitutional arrangements. Not that Parliament governs, it can't do that. 650 MPs can't govern, but it holds government to account. And that, after all, is what democracy is about. I mean, there are other ways of having a government through an authoritarian leader or a dictator or something else, but of course, they're not the British way. And from time immemorial, or let's be more precise, from medieval times, I think the date is 1340, we've had a parliament which has scrutinised government. And then in the 17th century, in these great constitutional battles, the ideological battles, if you like, Parliament wrested power from an authoritarian monarch, and Parliament established a constitutional monarchy. And also, and I think this is important, it established our freedoms, habeas corpus, trial by jury, and so on. They all began in the 17th century with parliamentary legislation. So Parliament lies at the very centre of our system in a way which perhaps it doesn't for countries on the continent.
And that's very important because throughout this long history, Parliament has often been called when there's been a crisis because the government has needed legislation and money. And in return for that, it's had to accept scrutiny. And I wonder whether you see very much the same is happening now, that the opposition is very keen to have scrutiny of the government, but the government also has to get a finance bill through to pay for all the extraordinary costs of the coronavirus.
Yes, as you say, the power of Parliament came because the king needed to raise money and could only do it with the consent of Parliament. And of course, that's true now, that the government needs to raise money and can only do it with the consent of Parliament. And that gives Parliament considerable leverage. And even in times of crisis like the present, or perhaps particularly in times of crisis, we do need to scrutinise what government is doing, because generally in times of crisis, governments do take more powers. That's essential. In the two world wars, in this present crisis, we have a Coronavirus Act 2020, which gives the government very considerable powers, and it's important that they be scrutinised. Now, some people have said during the present crisis that we should have a government of national unity, the sort we had in two world wars. But I didn't think that would be right, because the opposition, although it broadly supports the measures the government is taking, nevertheless wants to scrutinise what's being done. And it's for the good both of government and opposition and the country that this happens, because a good and effective opposition does keep government on its toes. Governments perhaps don't always appreciate that, but I think it's true all the same.
I agree with that. I think it's scrutiny not just by the opposition, but also by backbench MPs, each one bringing views and information from an individual constituency to explain how government policy nationally is having an effect locally, which ought to lead to better government. And I just wondered whether you think that generally happens, and whether government is willing to act on the information that it receives.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, and it's something that's often underappreciated. We had an example quite recently, the other day in Parliament, when Mark Fletcher, the new MP for Bolsover, raised the issue of domestic violence during the coronavirus crisis. And this is something which needs to be brought to the attention of government, and government, I hope, will try and do something about it insofar as it can. There's another example before the crisis in 2015, when a new then Conservative MP, Heidi Allen, raised questions about welfare benefits, which the then government took into account and altered its policy. And a lot of these initiatives by MPs, perhaps they don't make the headlines, but they do, as you suggest, relate to important matters concerning constituents. And many constituents, perhaps most constituents, they have interests which aren't necessarily those of the grand themes of party debate. For instance, if you're a small farmer or small businessman, you may be interested in quite technical details about how legislation might affect your farm or your business. And so the MPs to raise it. And with our system, they are able to keep in touch with constituents' needs on a completely non-party basis. A lot of the issues don't have much to do with the adversarial issues which form the stuff of the ideological debate, but they are very important, probably more important to many people.
And do you think that Parliament is managing to do this in its virtual format that we've now currently got? Do you think that is as effective scrutiny, or is it simply important that some level of scrutiny continues?
It is more difficult. It's important, obviously, to keep scrutiny going, but equally, we mustn't risk the health of MPs and officials. And at the moment, no more than 50 MPs can actually attend the Commons. And obviously, it's not ideal. It's necessary, but it's not ideal. Someone said once that politics is a contact sport, and you need to be there, really, to have full effect. But obviously, these are extraordinary circumstances, and it's important that we take measures to deal with them. But the government is still being kept on its toes, I think. You've got forensic questions from the leader of the opposition, Sir Keir Starmer, who's himself a lawyer, of course, and that is important. And I think governments take notice of it. Churchill, in the Second World War, could be a bit dismissive of Parliament. And he once said to the Labour politician, Sir Stafford Cripps, that there were only two things he was frightened of, God and the House of Commons. And Cripps said, well, I hope you treat God with a bit more respect than you treat the House of Commons. But nevertheless, the Commons was there and did on occasion enforce decisions against the will even of Churchill's enormously popular government.
And the government in return needs its legislative programme because, you know, there was a large majority in December, lots of promises made in the manifesto, and Parliament sitting to get that business done seems to me also important democratically, that what people voted for just a few months ago can't be forgotten, even with the crisis going on.
Yes, we talk a lot about parliamentary scrutiny, but of course it's a fundamental principle of our constitution that the Queen's government must be carried on, and people don't like it when government is prevented from carrying out policies by Parliament. Perhaps you saw that in the hung Parliament of 2017 and 2019, when some people, perhaps a majority, said, well, look, we have voted in a referendum for taking Britain out of the European Union, but MPs seem to be trying to get round that result. And when you had the hung parliaments of the 1970s, people said, well, government's blocked, it can't do anything, it can't take effective action, particularly in relation to the trade unions. There's a kind of split personality amongst many people. They say sometimes the government's too strong, it's an elective dictatorship. When you have hung parliaments and governments aren't so strong, they complain that we don't have leadership. So it's all a question of finding the right balance. And I think on the whole, one could suggest improvements and reforms. We've not done too badly.
And you made the point at the beginning of our conversation that Parliament and the government are different things and that you can't have a government of 650 people. And the experience 2017 to 19 was very ineffectual, wasn't it? It didn't cover Parliament in glory, but it didn't cover the government in glory either, that we just looked like a country that couldn't do anything.
Yes, but I think we shouldn't draw too many conclusions from what was, after all, an episode. Some people have said that this calls for a constitutional rebalancing between government and parliament. But we have to remember, first, we had a hung parliament. But second, we had this unique issue of Brexit, which divided both parties. Now, I don't think those two factors, a hung parliament and key issue which divides both parties, I don't think that will occur very frequently. So I don't think we ought to draw general conclusions from what happened between 2017 and 2019. And it's worth remembering the previous hung parliament we had in 2010 resulted in a coalition government which had a majority in parliament and operated more or less as a single party government would have done.
And was very effective. It seems to me one of the problems was the Fixed Term Parliament Act that made it impossible to get the constitutional long stop in operation, that is to say, a general election. When we finally got an election, it sorted everything out. But the Fixed Term Parliament Act was grafted onto the Constitution in a way that made life very difficult, 2017 to 19. And once that's gone, we will be back to a more normal system where you've got the emergency break, the long stop, whatever you want to call it.
Yes, I'm afraid that's right. And this shows the danger, perhaps, of legislating on constitutional matters for a specific problem. And so I think you're right that this is not a good piece of legislation. And on the whole, I prefer a prime ministerial power of dissolution to a parliament which can't do anything continuing, which happened a bit in 2018-19. And also, I think a prime minister ought to be able to make an issue a vote of confidence, which was how Edward Heath got the European Communities Act in 1972 through in the first place. He said, this isn't passed, I will call a general election. And he got it through with a majority of 8 on second reading. Now, Theresa May would have liked to do that with the withdrawal bill, but she couldn't because the Fixed Term Parliament Act said that a confidence vote is detached from a substantial vote and can only be on a specific vote of confidence. You can't attach it to any other measure. So that rather handicapped governments. And it went against the principle that the Queen's government must be carried on.
And that, I think, brings us nicely back to the beginning, that if people don't like the law, they need to change it. And to change it, they need Parliament. And Parliament needs to be sitting and provide the scrutiny and the legislative change that is required. And if that has to be virtual, so be it, and that's within the traditions of our constitution.
Yes, absolutely. And we're doing our best in current circumstances. It's interesting, the government has decided to pass emergency legislation by using primary legislation, the Coronavirus Act of 2020, which I mentioned earlier, and not governed by decree or using secondary legislation under, for example, the Civil Contingencies Act of 2004. This, I think, hasn't been widely noticed, but is to the government's credit. It's not seeking to bypass Parliament. These things can be scrutinised.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for that, and thank you for this fascinating conversation. I always enjoy and learn from our conversations. I know you've written that to be a political leader is essentially to be a teacher, but I think you're, on that basis, much more of a political leader than I am, because you're certainly the better teacher. But thank you very much for agreeing to do this podcast.
I'm extremely grateful to Professor Bogdaner for his time, and I hope you enjoyed our discussion too. Our conversation raised some further pressing questions, not least the one of how government ministers listen and respond to the views of backbenchers. I am looking forward to exploring this further in episode 2 with a former MP who has played an historic role in championing backbenchers' rights. Until then, goodbye for now.